Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 178. Thank you for tuning in, guys. And thank you for all the love for last week's, number one, last week's episode with Jean Grey. A lot of people saying that's their favourite episode or instantly in their top few. So that's lovely. And a lot of love for the Ask Pip secret episode, the bonus episode I snuck out there. I put one out on Friday. If I get any time over the next week or so, I'll do another bonus episode. If you want to ask some questions, go to my Facebook page and have a bit of a scroll and find the Ask Pip bit. And I'll answer any that are on there, or as many as I can, if I get a chance. So go and do that. What else do I need to tell you about? This week's guest is Johnny Lee Miller. That's pretty bloody awesome. I should mention that... This coming Saturday 25th of November is the last We Are Lizards of the year. That's my club night where I book a load of really good DJs. I DJ myself in a rubber lizard mask. It's at the Book Club in Hoxton. Yeah, come down. It's our last one of the year. I'll be there. Chris and Stu will be there from the Drunk Cast and Hardcore Listing. We've got tons of amazing DJs and it's going to be a great time, and it's our last one, so I want to see as many of you as possible. Also, I mean, obviously I'm going to plug speechdevelopmentrecords.com, where I've recently topped up the signed section, so I've got books in there, my DVD signed, some records signed. If you did have any of that stuff and wanted it personalised, the club night is the one place that you'll be able to grab me before Christmas, essentially. So if you had anything that... Obviously, you could just go and buy a signed copy, and that's quite a nice little Christmas present. But if you wanted anything personalised, I'm at them events from beginning to end. So just come and say hello. Ask me to sign anything you want. Let's have a chat. Let's hang out a bit. So that's good. But yeah, we are brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Christmas is coming and winter is here. So we've got loads of winter stuff. And we've just got loads of good gifts. I list it every week, but just go and have a browse. If you've been listening to the podcast for the last 3 years, where I've had at least one episode a week without missing a single week for over 3 years now, and they're free, then maybe you might, if you've got some spare cash, then maybe you might go and spend a bit of money and support the label and myself and the podcast and all that kind of thing. If you don't want to, you don't have to. Speechdevelopmentrecords.com is where you can go if you should choose to. So I've mentioned the club night. I've mentioned that. I've not mentioned next week's episode. Yeah, but in fact, I'm going to tell you about the episodes I've got lined up for the rest of the year. So next week's episode is Rick Edwards, and it's great. We talk about the podcast and book he's got that's all about the science behind movies. It's absolutely fascinating. It's an absolute nerd out of points, but genuinely some fascinating, fascinating stuff. So that's going to be next week. In between these, if I get a chance, I'm going to sneak these bonus episodes out on a Friday answering your questions. It's basically a case of if I've got enough questions to answer and I've got time. So I'll do some of them for you guys as a little extra treat. I know it just occurred to me that not many podcasts release towards the end of the week, and I know probably most of you got enough podcasts that you struggle to keep up anyway, but I thought it'd be cool to start sneaking these out as a little bonus if you want to listen to them. No pressure though, it's just me on my own rambling, so feel free to skip them. Then the week after that, I've got a special episode on vinyl from the author of Vinyl Matters, and we're going to have a big discussion about the history of vinyl, of music, of all sorts of stuff. It's going to be a really interesting one. So that's coming up. Also, I'm going to do, before the year is out, I'm going to do my top films of 2017. For years, I've done an Instagram post and Facebook post of my top films, and it always gets a lot of debate and discussion. And I thought that this year it'd be cool to do it as a podcast. And I've started to be ridiculously tight on it. So every film I've gone to see this year, I've made a note of. So I've got a list in my notes of every film I've seen, and I've got stars by the ones I think are potentially going to be in my films of the year list. So yeah, I'll do that podcast, and that'll be cool. And then it'll be Drunk Cast time. And the Drunk Cast this year is pretty special. It's a network special. So it's going to have Jim Smallman from Tuesday Night Jaw, the owner or one of three owners of Progress Wrestling, and great stand-up comedian and podcast host. Susie Gage, Dr. Susie Gage from the Say Why to Drugs podcast, who was also a guest recent on Hardcore Listing, picking her top five BBC comedies. Jason Reed from the Stop and Search podcast, who've had guests so far, including Robin Ince, Marcus Brigstock, Rufus Hounds, some amazing people. And Chris and Stu from Hardcore Listing, who started off on the Drunk Cast. Now, here's where it gets fun. Susie is obviously a doctor, so she's going to hopefully bring a breathalyzer and also do some cognitive brain tests along the way to see the effects of the alcohol on us as we get hammered and talk nonsense. Jim Smallman is straight-edged, so obviously he's not going to be drinking, but his dear friend and Progress Wrestling and UK wrestling legend, the winner of this year's Tournament of Death in America, Jimmy Havoc, is going to be coming along to drink on behalf of Jim Smallman. And this is awesome because Jimmy Havoc is a much requested guest from you guys. So it's going to be a hell of a drunk cast. We're going to have our usual nonsense, but then we're also going to have some science thrown in there, some wrestling thrown in there, some people drinking on behalf of others. It's going to be a hell of a time. So I'm going to be putting them out kind of over Christmas and New Year, to give you plenty to listen to if you choose to, but equally, you're not going to miss any specific guests who are in at specific times, if that makes sense. But the Drunk Cast will be there for when you come back to work, if you're a listener on the way to work. But yeah, anyway, there's going to be them. They're going to be great fun. And then there's going to be tons of good ones in the new year, I promise you. I've got some really exciting guests lined up. If you think we've ended the year strong with Fassbender and Russell Howard and Ashlyn B and Armando Iannucci and Jean Grey and Johnny Lee Miller and, oh man, we've had, it's a strong end to the year. I think Eddie Izzard, I think we can all agree it's a pretty strong end to the year. I'm continuing the new year in equally a strong manner, trust me. So that's the plan. I'll get on with this podcast now. I got a chance to speak with Johnny Lee Miller when I was in New York a few weeks back, and we had a lovely, lovely chat. He's an absolute dude. I've been a fan of him for a long time, and we've kind of connected over social media a little bit. So, he's great, and this is a great episode. I hope you enjoy it. I'll be back at the end. I probably haven't got that much important to say. I've rambled on like a maniac in the intro, so feel free to... Oh, no, actually, if you stick around at the end, you might get one of my Pips Pod Picks, where I recommend new podcasts or podcasts you might not have listened to. So that's a new section at the end. I used to have adverts in there, but it's not a desired advertising slot because a lot of people don't listen to the end. And I have adverts at the start and stuff. So I decided I'd fill that slot. Instead of renting it out, I'd fill that slot with some recommendations for you guys to find more podcasts and spread the love. So yeah, I'll be back at the end with all that stuff, and I'll see you in a bit. Right, I'm joined today by Johnny Lee Miller. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. And we're in New York, which is exciting. We're currently in my suite in Brooklyn. I'm only here for 2 days. That's why I'm living so large. It's not bad. But how are you?
I'm very well, very well.
You're having a bit of a run around.
Yeah, today's pretty hectic. It's been pretty hectic. Me and my son went training together.
Mm-hmm.
We went and did a little jiu-jitsu.
Amazing.
And then we went home and washed.
Perfect.
And then that's, I dropped him off at a birthday party. So
I've got this is I'm showing you my phone. I have notes on my phone where I've planned it, and the first thing I've put is, let's annoy your fan base and my fan base by starting off with discussing Brazilian jiu-jitsu a bit. Because that's not what anyone wants to hear, but I do.
I'll talk about that all day.
How long have you been rolling?
I've only been rolling for 2 years.
Yeah.
And
you loving it?
I love it. I've always done martial arts, this martial art, that martial art. I sort of, you know, flitted around most of my youth trying to find one or find a school that I liked, or which is key.
Yeah, completely.
Then I found a great school in London, and I, which was kickboxing. And I did, you know, pretty much freestyle kickboxing for a few years.
Yeah.
You know, got fairly competent at it. Then I moved to the States, and I just sort of dropped it because the school was so key to me. The people, the vibe, and it was a very unique place there.
I think it has
a friendly place.
Because it has to be somewhere that you're willing to go constantly. I know when I was briefly rolling, I stopped because of how busy I was, and I felt it disrespectful to be the guy that turns up every month or two. Do you know what I mean? I felt you need to be there.
If
particularly
you
when you're starting
make,
off, you need to be there
if you want
at least
make progress.
Once a week. Preferably twice a week. Ideally three or four times a week.
Yeah.
You know?
If you want to make any progress. Yeah. Especially, so, I mean, I've been flitting around, and then I found this Muay Thai gym on my hiatus a couple of years ago. I found this Muay Thai gym.
Yeah.
Just, you know, internet, walked in, friendliest people ever.
Amazing.
And it's really become my social hub, really.
Yeah.
And then they have the jiu-jitsu over there. And I've always been like, jiu-jitsu, but, you know, I hear it's great. I hear it's really effective. I hear it's really this and that. But I've always been like, no, I don't play with that, you know. It's not my thing. And then they run classes concurrently at the gym, and you don't pay any extra for any of the other gyms. So eventually I was like,
I'm here.
I'll try jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And just loved it. I love it, absolutely. I do both now.
Gi or no gi?
Both.
Both, amazing. Because, again, I think that's what's... The only reason I started a rolling was because I'm such a fan of watching MMA and watching Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu now. And so I was training to get a better understanding of what I'm watching. And it does. It gives you... You are far more excited watching the ground game.
Absolutely.
If you know that slight movement
you're
is
watching
giving
them
away.
To try and gain position. You're watching that progression of movement. But, you know, I'm 44 years old. And I'm one of the oldest guys in the class... I just love that. I love the idea of starting at the bottom again.
Yeah.
I love the idea of being, you know, the new guy, the beginner. And I something about me just relishes that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's humbling. That jiu-jitsu's got so many metaphors for life, isn't it? So many parallels.
100%.
It keeps you humble because somebody chokes you out, they choke you out. There's nothing you can do about it. You tap out. You have to surrender.
Yeah.
And
I saw
a
meme yesterday about jiu-jitsu that was just showing that it was a picture of like a bully beating up a nerd or something. It said in jiu-jitsu this never ends. So it's got a blue belt and a white belt doing that, and then at the end it's just then black belts will be doing that to black belts. It never, like, that progression never ends.
There's always somebody better.
But the beauty of it as well, particularly gi, I've never done a gi myself, but from what I've read is gi puts it so much on technique. So it doesn't matter if you're the oldest there, the strongest there, the weakest there. It gets the more if you can develop that technique and skill, it's a martial art that's such a leveler. It doesn't matter how big you are, small you are, if you've got the technique right.
Yeah, I think to a certain degree.
Yeah,
to a certain degree. You know, size doesn't matter unless size knows how to fight.
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
in which
of course,
it really matters.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. But, you know, our teachers have always stressed both gi and no gi complement each other.
Yeah.
And the thing I like about the gi is grips.
Yeah, of course.
I love being able to frustrate somebody by holding on to them. I like to get that strong grip. And I like the feeling afterwards of having, like, numb fingers.
Yeah.
You know.
The absolute exhaustion of the arms after you've been
going for
a while.
Yeah, exhaustion is pretty much
well.
Everything. Yeah.
How long was it until you could actually consciously do things on the mat? Because I always remember the first few times I'd rolled with mates, and the first few times I went into a class, all I was thinking of was try and stop him doing what he's trying to, like, rather than thinking anything more. I was like, oh, what's he? I rolled at 10th a planet in LA.
Oh,
once,
great, yeah, yeah.
And literally, like, Eddie Bravo had been saying, oh, just come down. I'm like, if you've got a beginner's class, like, just come down. And because they were so far ahead of me, all I could think of was trying to stop them doing whatever they're doing. I was saying to Eddie afterwards, if the guy had known, all he would have had to do is try to not put me in a guillotine, and I would have popped myself into it. Just because I couldn't have any logic in my head. It was like, oh, where's he trying to put my arm? I don't want it to go there then.
you know, rather than any actual tactics or calmness.
It's like they pretty much told us, you know, you'll be just confused and beaten up for a few months and it won't make any sense. We'll go over some techniques, then we'll move on to something else next week and you won't remember it. But then the cycle of techniques sort of comes around.
Yeah.
And it's really, we go live rounds in your first class.
Yeah.
So some schools don't do that.
Yeah.
But we do half drilling and then live rounds.
Yeah.
And you're in the deep end. Because we're a young class. The gym has only been doing jiu-jitsu for... No, I think they've always had it, but it's sort of a youngish group. Yeah, like there's no one who has been promoted to higher than blue belt out of that gym yet.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Anyone who's got a higher belt has been promoted somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And it's an amazing sport for someone in your industry and in your position, because it is an industry that there's going to be a tendency, not necessarily to develop an ego or anything like that, but to get...
You could say that.
You will, yeah, but you will get to the point completely where, because of, even on a realistic level, if you've got a hard, long day on set, you're going to have someone constantly... Or bringing you your drinks, or bringing you your food, or bringing you your coat, or things like that in between. So that's just how it has to be to get the best out of your performance. But that can then go into your mind as that's how life is. So as soon as you get into the gym, it's not that at all.
I run out of work when I can. If I don't, you know, if I'm not with my kid or whatever, then I'll run out of work and I'll go there. Yeah. For me, it's like going to the pub.
Yeah.
Used to be.
That's great.
Because it's, instead of drinking, we're like learning something together and we still have the same kind of laugh, probably more.
Yeah.
I reckon.
Yeah.
Well, personally,
Yeah, completely. And more coherently. More consistently.
I don't know about that.
A push. So what has led you to New York? When did you move out of here?
I moved here 5 years ago.
Because it's a five and a half
years ago.
Yeah.
I was living in LA. I lived in LA for the 7 years before that straight.
Yeah.
And I got a job. I got a job on a CBS show.
Yep.
And it shoots here, and that's why we moved here.
It's as simple as that.
You know, been doing that same job ever since.
Yeah.
I mean, we're probably coming towards the end of it, but I will stay here because my son's in school here. He's a New Yorker, as am I now, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I absolutely love it, and it was a lot better for me. Like I don't really dislike Los Angeles at all.
Mm-hmm.
I love it, and I've got some really good friends there. But just being that 3,000 miles closer to the UK, makes communication with the UK a lot easier.
It makes a big difference.
You know, it makes it easier to sort of go back and see family and stuff. Makes a huge difference.
It's that shorter trip. I like
seasons.
Yeah.
And this city,
New York,
is
more British, isn't it?
It's more British. It is, actually. And the more you find out about the city, the sort of more surprising it is. I used to associate it with the place that you'd come over from London and sort of have a mad time.
Yeah.
In the 90s, or, you know, it was a wild escape to the big city and we'd go nuts.
Yeah.
But it's a very child-friendly city.
Yeah.
It's a great place to raise a kid. And it's sort of a maritime city as well.
Right, yeah, of course.
Which I really feel, it's surrounded by water. There's boats going up and down everywhere, and bridges everywhere, and little ports everywhere, and ferries. And it's got this real connection to the beaches in the neighbouring, you know, out here in Brooklyn and, you know, in Long Island. And Yeah, so much more to
it. It's got so many different things in one. In, as you said, the beaches and almost the kind of seaside culture, with Coney Island and stuff like that.
And, and even if you get out Jersey Shore and all that stuff, or whatever your flavour is, whatever it is, it's there. Yeah,
that's it. I think I love LA as well, but I think LA is probably as mixed culturally, but New York, that cultural mix is unavoidable.
Yeah,
like in LA, there's like you can be in LA and ever see white people or something like that. Whereas you come to New York and the cultural mix is just vast and amazing. I did an hour's walk and just went through so many different communities, and it was a beautiful thing
to see. You're absolutely right. You're forced to. And in LA, you That's the reason I'd rather.
I said it's still good in LA. That's what I was careful on, Matt.
Yeah, because you get in your car and you've got to go. You've got to arrange who you're going to meet and where you're going to meet them.
Yeah.
Like, and then you get in the car to get there. Yeah. So you sort of
you miss it.
You choose your own adventure.
Yeah.
And in New York, you're confronted with every, as you say, every different economic background just on your way to school in the morning. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like just getting on the subway, like it, you're forced to confront it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were saying you feel Elementary is kind of coming to its conclusion.
Well,
right?
I'll touch wood. I mean, we've got a short season this year.
Yeah.
Because usually we shoot 24 episodes a year, and this year they ordered like 13, and it really depends on how the rest of CBS's new shows go.
Yeah, sure,
like,
of course.
So we might get they might order an extra 4 or 5 for us, and then that might be it. But they won't tell us that's definitely it.
Yeah.
So we could we could come back for season 7, which I'd love to do. But we just don't know.
How's it been? Because I think I remember at the time reading that you were cautious of taking it because of the UK Sherlock that was being made. But it makes me think of the American Office. In that I love the British Office, but the American Office became its own beast, and I absolutely adore that. It's hard to say if I like it more. I think I probably do like it more. But it's that thing that it went off on its own and just.
Yeah.
Spanned out. And it's similar with Elementary, I think, because the UK Sherlock, you know, 3 episodes here, 4 episodes there.
Yeah.
And you guys were really able to take it in a different direction, change the characters, keep the core and the root of Sherlock Holmes, but, you know, take it on its own a journey and adventure.
Yeah, and the base material is... So has been told so many. I mean, it's been told a lot before.
Yeah.
So it's sort of different in your other sort of US British interpretations in that way. Is the fact that it's got such a massive canon of work already behind it. Those characters, the modernization bit. Yeah,
yeah.
That's very that was the main thing. But we've sort of been able to sort of fit that serialized. Idea that I mean the Holmes books originally came out in serialized little mini stories and in a weird way, completely unintentionally, I think US network television sort of fit that.
Completely, because that's it.
You make cute little stories. Some of them are sort of standalone, but there is an ongoing thread with all of the characters as well. You know
exactly. Those weird little mysteries and adventures in the individual episode, and then. A couple of seasons in, and you're like, "Oh, hang on, I'm into this whole character and all these individuals, rather than just, oh, how did they do it, and how's he going to figure this out?"
I think they do a good job, the writers doing that.
But. It's great. So, let's kind of go all the way back. You grew up in the UK, right? In London?
Yeah, in Kingston.
In Kingston,
Kingston upon Thames.
Nice. And was acting always. As something you wanted to do because your dad was an actor, so it was in the family as such.
Yeah, my dad really was an actor for a minute, but he was a stage manager, as was my mum. But my granddad was an actor.
Yeah.
So yeah, like you're always like you're fully right around the you're on the inside of like something. My dad worked at the BBC.
Yeah.
As a sort of floor manager, in charge of a group of floor managers, like. Assistant directors kind of thing. So we were always going there and seeing behind the scenes and watching like Top of the Pops get recorded.
Amazing.
And really amazing. And Grandpa was in like a load of Bond movies and stuff. So I think you got a sort of connection to that world. And then, I don't know, it was just from being at... You kind of either have that like gene or you don't really.
Yeah.
Like the little school plays and getting up and performing was never really... scary to me. It was sort of empowering. I was a pretty chilled out, outgoing little boy. I got like much shyer much later.
Right. That's kind of a good way around to do it, have that fearlessness to start things off, right?
But yeah, I think from like super early age, that's it. That's what I was going to do, really.
It must have been great to have that exposure to seeing the behind the scenes, because most people will only see the finished product on the TV. So getting that exposure would let you know, is it acting I want to do? Is it camera work? Is it lighting? Is it directing? And getting to see all of that, or the realities of it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, not so much of it. Like, you know, I think in the theatre as well, I really got to see like how that worked.
Yeah,
which was key. And theatre's a huge part of my life.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was always really going to be like acting. Now it's like, no, I just directed, actually.
Yeah.
First time I was like, I should have done that earlier.
And how was that?
Oh, it's just brilliant. Loved it.
It seems like there's so many things, again, in every industry, but particularly in this industry, that you can spend ages telling yourself, oh, I don't know how to do that, or I can't do that.
Yeah.
And then you do it and go, oh, no, I do.
I think...
Particularly someone who's been directed a lot. Like, you do know how to do that because you've experienced it.
Someone who's sort of been, you know, mentored me, the great thing about, you know, where I work now, and that is that it affords you the opportunity. I directed an episode of Elementary.
Amazing.
So I'm working with people that I know, on sets that I know, not all of them, but like the sets that we have built, like I know how they work. I know I can look at angles. So all the
safe environment as well.
For over 100 and something episodes, I've been looking at stuff and thinking, I'd like to do it. I'd do this that way.
Yeah.
And someone said to me, look, you know, you know more than you think you do. And then you realise that. But part of me also needed to watch for 35 years.
100%. 100%. Again, what a great way to learn, right? Having that in front of you and seeing. And again, that's a great point of seeing what your instinct says, I wouldn't have done it like that.
Exactly.
So not only seeing how people do it and what's good, but also going, I would have done that differently.
Yeah, and you've then got to step up and test yourself and say, all right then, you think you know how to do it.
Yeah.
You better do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I did. And I just absolutely loved it. And I found it like way more relaxing.
Yeah.
You've got more responsibility, but less pressure in a way. Because, you know, the actor performance is like everything. It's all like, it's all bullshit, 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 blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Get ready, get ready, get ready, get ready, and go. And like everything's wrong at this, you know, stand here, do that. Oh, noise, wait, hang on. And be Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
I find that quite stressful because you've got to learn lines and then everyone's looking at you and you've got to get it right. But in being sort of more in charge of the whole thing and being involved in every aspect of it, from casting to what the props look like to the locations that we use to talking to the actors and getting them to do it sort of comes... comes afterwards and then, you know, I'm already working with a group of actors that really know what they're doing.
Yeah.
As long as you cast people that know what they're doing, you know, that's most of the thing. But I found it super relaxing and sort of invigorating and really connected me to the whole project again.
Yeah, that's great because you're in a way you've got longer to get your head around it all because you're looking at it from so much further early on. Whereas like when you're just acting it, you'll be getting the sides or whatever however long in advance. Whereas if you're
When we direct an episode, you start
really prepping, got your head around it.
Start prepping the episode when they start shooting the episode before.
Yeah.
So I was doing both for a minute. I was acting in the episode before whilst prepping the episode I was directing.
That's intense.
And now I'm editing
the
episode I shot and we're shooting
whilst filming the next one.
Yeah. So I walk on set, I just talk nonsense because I'm like, what are we doing? Who's dead?
It's the madness of TV, and I don't know if it's specifically American, I guess it's TV in general, that it always feels like so much is going on at once. And over here, where a lot of shows are airing as they're filming and stuff like that, it's all
that
kind
happens
of,
here, yeah. It doesn't happen in the UK, I don't think.
No,
but that,
the first series I did was called The Bastard's Execution. It was filmed in the UK, but it was 4FX, and I was I hadn't been told, like, I had a small role, so I hadn't been told like when it was starting. I was like, so when's this looking like it might come out? And they're like, oh, episode one starts on Sunday. And I was like, what? We're filming episode four at the moment. Like, how's that the case?
Yeah, they roll because we start a normal network show, for example, which is like 20-something episodes, much longer than your cable or Showtime, whatever. That'll start shooting in maybe in the July or August. And then if it premieres in the fall, autumn.
Yeah.
By the time you're like way ahead.
Yeah.
But then by the time the end of the season rolls around in May, April.
Yeah.
April, May, you're literally, it's really like down to the wire.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
So is that something you see yourself doing a lot more of a directing.
Yeah, I'd love to direct something. Your toe in. I'd love to direct something that I'm not in.
Yeah,
because you know, I would. That's what I would really enjoy it when I could get out of the costume and really focus on the job at hand. And I think that's important to do. I'd much rather do that. And you know, it's one of my dreams is to like make a movie. You know, I've got stuff in my head and. That's one of my dreams. Now I know that I can, like, it's amazing when you get those little pieces. Like, oh, now I can go ahead and I know I'll achieve it one day.
It's that verification, isn't it? It's going, oh, you can. So now the pressure's all on you to go, right, now I need to get it to there.
But I know I can now. I know it's going to happen. Like, amazing. If I hadn't taken that step, I sort of, for 4 years doing elementary, 5 years, was too scared to do it because I didn't want to, like, do two jobs. Rubbish. I wanted to do one job really well, but I didn't want to do two jobs not that great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but then I've watched Lucy do it. Lucy Liu. She directed her first episode in season two. She's done one a year for that. Amazing. And so I was watching her and I was thinking, you know, I've got to do it. If I don't do it, I'll regret it for the rest of my life in this environment, you know.
And what a safe environment. To do it in, because it's the crew you know and trust.
Yeah,
and
they're all rooting for me, and the director of photography I have a really good relationship with. Me and him, we had a great time.
Yeah,
you know,
it's the perfect situation. To get into it. So what was your route into acting then? Exposed at an early age, did you find yourself, or did you find stage first, or film and TV?
With a school stage.
Yeah, of course.
But that actually led to an incredible organisation called the National Youth Music Theatre, who are responsible for the likes. It's where I met my best friend, Jude Law, and that they sort of did a co-thing with my school. And I was like 12 years old.
Yeah.
And they came and did a play there, sort of the school play. But then we sort of re-auditioned and they brought a national cast into this production, which we had workshopped and developed, really.
Yeah.
It was an original piece. And then we took it to the Edinburgh Festival. And then we ended up taking it, you know, a bunch of different places. And I sort of stayed with that company for like 4 or 5 years. And they would work only in school holidays. So it wasn't not professional. It was amateur.
But what an amazing experience to go and do that at the Fringe and stuff like that.
Oh, at the Fringe, and we went to the, like, you know, to Devon and all kinds of places, Greece, Norway.
Wow.
All in school holidays. So you'd meet all these kids from all over the UK.
Yeah.
It's produced people like Matt Lucas was in the NYMT, Eddie Redmayne, Sally Hawkins.
Oh, wow.
To name but a few, Jude, but I'm missing... I'm missing a bunch as well. It was really incredible sort of time.
Yeah.
And that was really like an education. It was a stage education. Touring, performing, workshopping. Really, it's like going to drama school without studying classics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And
just on the job learning.
On the job learning, you know? Yeah. Child labour.
Yeah, exactly. But again, it's great that's available in this industry, because again, you generally have work experience and stuff like that, and stuff where you'll go and learn a trade. So why not in acting and performing?
It was really the brainchild of a man called Jeremy James Taylor, and it was really down to him, really. And I did 4 or 5 years with that, and then I actually had an agent. I got an agent when I was like 9 or 10.
Wow.
Because, I don't know, how did that happen? I don't know, somebody in Kingston, like in the neighbourhood or whatever, she ran a kids agency.
Right.
My mum heard about it. So we went along and I went along, talked to her, and then I got a couple of little jobs. This is like before the school youth theatre thing.
Yeah.
And I was on like 3 shows, like little speaking parts.
Yeah.
And got an equity card. Like, and back then, you couldn't just get an equity, you couldn't just join a union for working. You had to get a number of hours. So I got my hours and I got my union card, like 1982 or something.
Yeah.
So I was sort of set up. And then I stayed at that kids agency. So without working, we forgot about that. I just did this amateur theatre stuff. And then when I left school at like 16 after my GCSEs, And I wasn't going to go to drama school because I had this card. I had an agent and a card. I'm like, what am I going to go to drama school for? Like,
you've already.
I'll just, like, I'm with him. I've been touring. Yeah. So I'm going to just crack on and go to auditions and stuff. So I got like a menial job and started going to auditions.
There's definitely a logic in that in anything in the arts. And that's not to discredit going and doing the arts in education. But in so many of them, it's about your experience and your portfolio and stuff like that. So why go somewhere and they say, oh, I've signed off that you can act? You can't exactly. Then take that into an audition and go, I don't need to audition. I've got my certificate that says I can act. You've still got to go on tape and do it right.
And you need representation. People go to drama school because their agents are scouring it and they want that. They go there and that's how they get an agent.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how they get auditions.
And if you've already got the agent and you're already getting the auditions, then...
Yeah. So it snowballed like that from there, really. And it was like a typical...
It's the British route, isn't it? It's the Bill, Casualty...
Minder. Inspector Morse.
Morse in there, amazing.
Oh, yeah, I did the Bill twice.
Twice.
You have to wait 18 months before you can be someone else.
Was it as two separate characters? Yeah. Brilliant.
There's a time cycle.
Brilliant.
Two miscreants. yeah, I had an epileptic fit in a cell on the Bill.
Amazing.
Wicked.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, Minder, worked with John Thor on Inspector Morse, like a couple of lines at the uni.
Amazing.
Yeah, good old days.
Again,
Casualty.
Yeah, I love those kind of staples of the amount of people I talk to who I've watched loads of their work, I've adored their work. As soon as I'm preparing for this and go on IMDb, there's EastEnders, Casualty, The Bill, and all of these kind of...
I was in EastEnders as well.
Yeah, so you've got the collection. That's in the south. If you go on the other side, it's Corrie and Brookside and Bread and all these other ones that are up there that are the staples of it. So that's a great mix. So how was it after that? Because what it appeared for me as a film fan was that you appeared overnight and were huge. But that obviously wasn't the case if you were doing all of these kind of gradual progressions.
No, not at all. I mean, I did, you know what, I even like my timeline's all messed up as well, but I mean, I did years of those little parts.
Yeah.
And then I sort of, when I was 19, I switched agencies and I did, I was doing theatre at, I did a play called Beautiful Thing at the Bush Theatre, which was, the old Bush Theatre.
Right.
But the pub and Shepherd's Bush.
Yes, it's moved now.
I think. Did a couple of plays, went with a grown-up agent.
Yeah.
And then actually, like, I got a movie called Hackers.
Yeah.
And that was the first thing I did.
That was it. I remember I remember 95 and 96, that Hackers came out and was so cool and so on point and advanced and futuristic. And then Trainspotting came out after that, and it was just these two, a double hitter of wow.
That's funny that you remember that, because I think what happened is, like, I shot Hackers first, then Trainspotting, and then but Trainspotting ended up coming out first.
Oh really?
Yeah. And then I was always bummed because I thought Hackers was pretty good. Hackers is like better now than it was then.
Yeah, I remember at the time being cult thing. Really into it. Exactly, it had that kind of
At the time, it wasn't as well received. Right. And everyone thought that after Trainspotting, I went off to the United States and did this Ponzi movie.
Yeah.
But it was not the case. Hackers was first, then Trainspotting.
How was it when Trainspotting came out? Because genuinely... just iconic, and Sick Boy being one of the standout characters and roles in that, and that must have been an amazing thing to be part of as your first big thing, really, I guess.
Yeah.
Or to come out, at least.
I don't know. What's weird is, it's like, what's weird is I was sort of running around the globe chasing my soon-to-be wife at the time, and I just ignored everything else that was going on.
Oh, really?
And I disappeared to LA for like 2 years in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
And I remember being at the premiere of Trainspotting in Glasgow, and then going back to America, I just sort of missed everything, really. I didn't really want to know, and opportunities were coming my way, but I was like squandering them like properly.
Oh really?
Oh yeah.
And why was that? A focusing elsewhere,
bad
or not
behavior.
Aware? Yeah, yeah.
A lot of bad behavior.
Because that was it. I remember both of those films at the time, and it being very much a what the hell is ahead for this, particularly Trainspotting, that whole ensemble cast, everyone in it, you were like, wow.
Yeah, I turned down a lot of good parts after that, which I won't name.
Yeah.
But because they went to, you know, great actors.
Yeah.
But I turned down a few things because I've always had problem seeing, or at the time I did, I had a problem sort of seeing what the next good move was, or what was good for me, or what I really wanted to do in my life.
Yeah.
And you know, I was a bit messed up, really, to be honest with you. Not living very healthy.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah.
Oh, it's all thrown at you all at once, isn't it? To go from not necessarily being that known to Trainspotting. And there was, I mean, it is worth mentioning that there was a big celebrity relationship there as well, which, again, it just pushes everything to the forefront. And maybe you were unaware of that because you're in LA, but particularly in the UK, how big Trainspotting was and how iconic it was. That's a lot. And you were the, whilst there was a lot of amazing characters, and obviously a Ewan was clearly in that lead, your character was the charming, handsome kind of character, you know. So it's very much that, even though it's an ensemble piece, that was the one that you would single out and go, a look at this guy.
I mean, you know? I was. It made me a lot of friends. Yeah,
yeah.
We had a good time.
Yeah,
but but it's like, it wasn't like career wise.
Yeah.
My door wasn't being knocked down.
And you
sort of, what happens is you get asked to sort of play that part again in a number of other projects.
Of course.
And then you sort of say no. I remember reading one script, it was like something, and you know, it was like literally like the blonde hair kind of cool dude, but like not as well written.
Right. I've done that.
I was like, no, I'm not, you know. So there was a lot of that goes on in this business, probably still to this day, you know.
That
happens. You're in a big breakout movie is one thing, but then you've got these big ideas of yourself.
Yeah.
Your ego's on fire, like, no, I'm an actor.
Yeah.
I'm going to be Robert De Niro, and I'm going to completely transform myself.
Yeah.
I'm Daniel Day-Lewis. You just don't know it yet.
You've seen one of my characters.
Yeah, exactly. I've got...
Did you see me
seven
in
more.
The bill?
Exactly.
Twice. Did you
see
two of them in the bill?
No, you didn't, because I disappeared. You didn't see it.
That's perfect. So what was the kind of, what do you feel, there was a point that kind of you reined yourself in, or you got hold of things, or was it kind of at that point just a bit of a spiral and a bit of a spiral
there? Disappeared to LA for a couple of years, came back 97.
Yeah.
You know, I worked pretty good. That's when I did this movie, Plunkett and McLean.
Yep. Yep.
You know, which was a decent effort. And I felt... You know,
reuniting with Robert.
And, I've always worked. I think I did go for like a period of time not working, but like a year once was the longest. And it was just, you know, a mixture of sort of it not being right for me. Because, I don't know what I was thinking, but...
And then I found
stuff sort of dried up for me in the UK. That's why I ended up in the States.
Yeah.
I mean, it really did. Through mostly my fault, I imagine, initially. But then you're like, wait a second, you know. And I wasn't really firing on all cylinders. I needed to straighten my life out as well, really. I needed to get my head straight.
It's an interesting one, because transferring over to the States, in many ways, I would see, would open you up to more roles, because regardless of what you took or didn't take in the UK, there would be certain roles that, because of the success of Trainspotting and Noam's Ovens, that you were seen as too big for that role, or too big to be that character. Whereas in America, you can kind of go, is it a good character, and is it something I want to do, regardless of, is it the lead, is it the support, is it this or that?
I was still having like theatrical success, theatre success. Like,
yes,
I did a play Feston at the Almeida, and 2003, I've always been super lucky with theatre. Like,
yeah.
I don't do it all the time, but when I do it, I'll only do it because I read a play and it's like I must do it, and it's,
yeah,
and it, the play is like knock me for six, and then I get very lucky with the directors that I've worked with on stage, yeah. You know, and it's always all of the projects I've ever done in theatre, all of them have been really special to me, and I'm just super proud of
and
them.
Really,
and I can't say that in other mediums, do you know what I mean?
And really acclaimed as well. And I think the thing that will maybe catch people off guard who knew you only as this guy that seemed to appear out of nowhere, they won't know that your family have been in theatre for a long time.
Yeah.
You've grown up around this. You've been on stage. You've toured things. So. There will be that element of surprise that's an area that you're almost more experienced initially than film and TV, or more at home at the very least.
Still more at home.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as far as you were saying about the character and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I always see myself as like a character actor.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of guys that do. I've, you know, even a few years ago, I was just trying to get like... I'd read a script and I'd go, I want to play that part, the funny, weird one.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the producers would be like, no, we just see him as more of a leading man. And you're like, fucking hell, well, no one's giving me leading man parts.
Yeah, sure.
So because I could do a really good job. Like, just try and look past that, you know?
Yeah.
But people are very, a lot of the time, they're not creative with the way they look at what you can do. They call you a good actor. They say to your face, you're a great actor.
Yeah.
But then they don't necessarily allow you to really go to town on something.
To go and push things and go in unusual directions and try.
You've got to show up. And that's when guys really... You've got to show up, I guess, like, transformed.
Yeah.
Or people aren't going to see it.
Or, I mean, I remember saying... and we'll get to Trainspotting 2... But we've got a lot in between that. I remember seeing on one of the interviews off the back of that where you were saying how one of the guys didn't know that you weren't Scottish until you got back somewhere or you spoke in your normal voice and there was this shock.
That
shows the...
That's you and Bremner.
That shows the deception of it almost, of becoming that character and going, look, I'm not what you might have thought I am. I can be this. I can be... And that's acting, right?
Yeah, but back then it was, you know, that's the beauty of being young and starting out and, you know, really being unknown and you can pull that stuff. I did it, you know, if you can get by in a pub in Glasgow.
Yeah.
And then it was the only way I was going to get a good Scottish accent was to just do it all the time and be in Scotland and do that. Although I did it, I was then doing a movie called Regeneration with James Wilby.
Right.
And I was supposed to be talking in a Newcastle accent. And we went out for dinner one night and I was doing my same thing, because that's what I do, that's what I knew, that's how I knew to be successful with accents, was to do them all the time. And he was like, can you stop talking like that? I went, no, you don't talk like that, it's just weird.
It's just throwing me.
Sorry.
That's amazing. So, I mean, we've skipped over one I wanted to touch on. A Love on an Obey was another one that I remember that coming out and just being... a huge kind of cult hit and a huge excitement. And working with Jude, who, again, had you worked
not
together?
Really. We had done a soap opera called Families in Manchester.
Right.
He was in that, like a regular...
Yeah.
When, God, that must have been like early 90s.
Right.
And then I did an episode of that with him.
Yeah.
But that was it.
Yeah.
So this was the first time... that was chaos.
Really?
Yeah, we didn't have a script.
In what way? Right, oh, wow.
No script. That film is all improvised.
Wow.
Which I think you can tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's rough around the edges.
Right, yeah.
It's all improvised. It was a bunch of mates. It was my mate Dominic, his sort of brainchild.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a lot of fun. But that's why it's so rough around the edges.
Yeah.
There was a basic story, but no, you know, we just fill in the blanks and hope for the best. Yeah, they did an interesting movie called Final Cut.
Yeah, I loved Final Cut.
I had both of them on video. That shows how good. Yeah,
but yeah, I thought that was a great film.
Interesting, and you know, they were the Operation Good Guys.
Yeah,
people,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Which is a really good series. Very funny.
Yeah, it was great, and that's what was interesting because Final Cut and Love on an Obey weren't comedy and weren't. Do you know what I mean? They were dramatic things. And I was recognising guys from Operation Good Guys and stuff like that.
Yeah,
all right, this is dramatic and harsh and heavy and, you know.
I suppose so. You know what? It's been a long time since I've seen it. I haven't really, because I was sort of like, what? I wasn't sure, you know. But if I get into a taxi cab in London,
yeah,
royalty,
yeah,
just because of that, not because of anything else.
I love it. I love it.
I love and obeys. It's the cab driver's number one movie.
Yeah, of course it is. And what's great there, and it jumped out at me as something I can relate to, is I'll have people every now and then quote my lyrics to me online, and if it's songs that's not made it into the live set, I've forgotten them, because the last time I said those lyrics was 8 years ago.
Yeah.
When that was recorded. And with a film like Lover on a Bow, when it was so improvised, yeah, it's not like you're going to have sat down and popped it on the TV at the weekend. So what other people have watched over and over again and got to know, you said in the spur of a moment 20 years ago or 10 years ago, however long ago, and it's like, exactly. I don't really know what happened in that film. I don't remember that film at all.
No.
I love it. So how was it? How did you find escaping to America as such and progressing there?
Brilliant. I mean, I love America and I love Americans.
Yeah.
And it's sort of one of my... I feel they're misrepresented all the time.
Yeah.
The real people, you know. Yeah. One of my basic tenets of life is that people are all the same anywhere, actually.
Yeah.
They're the same absolutely everywhere you go. There's just different sort of general shifts.
Yeah.
If you clump everybody together, you get a general shift. But you separate people out, you know, they're the same.
Yeah, I think.
And they just sound different, and they sort of have different customs, but they're the same, and they laugh, and they have the same sense of humours, and there's different, you know, certain things. But Americans are so they have an enthusiasm, really, in the business, which I felt I was missing, and I feel it's a much tougher business in London, and sort of a more cynical business in London.
Yeah.
But then people are like, no, you shouldn't do that, or this is rubbish, this is that in the UK. But in America, they'll give it a shot.
Yeah. But I think that's where people think or misconceive a falseness, because there is that excitement to give things a try. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. It's not a guarantee of anything.
I think you might be right.
Yeah.
Misconstrue it as bullshit.
Yeah. It's like, no, they're genuinely excited about a lot of stuff when it's stuff that you should be excited about. Yeah. You're making films, you're making TV shows. That should be exciting.
And from a selfish point of view, I went over there and people are like, oh my God, we're so excited to see you. Oh, what about this project? Oh, look at this. Yeah. Oh, you'd be great for that. Oh my God, you're so, you know. Whereas my experience of the UK, whether I'd painted myself into that corner or not, was not that at all.
Right.
So I'm like, okay. So I went over in 95 and like in autumn 95 and... By 2006, I'm shooting a TV show with Ray Liotta, right?
Yeah.
And it was a CBS show called Smith.
Yeah.
And I was like, he's the lead, but I'm like one of the regulars.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. We only lasted 7 shows.
Wow.
Because it was too expensive.
Right.
So the studio cut it, like dropped it. But still, it was brilliant experience, and there we were, and then I met somebody, and I'm like moved in with them, and then I got this other project landed on my desk, I don't have a desk. I said that in my lap.
Landed in your lap, yeah.
Called Eli Stone, and this was like a promotion because it was like to the it actually didn't land in my lap. It was the audition that did.
Yeah,
I had to audition for it. I had to audition for the studio heads. And I got it, and that was a lead role. And we ended up we were going to do a whole season, but there was a writer's strike.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So we only did half a season, but I was working at Buena Vista Stages in Disney, you know, which is Disney.
Yeah.
On an ABC show.
In the lead.
Yeah. And like, I know I sound like, oh, look at me, but these things are not lost on me. Like, when I'm driving out of the lot,
completely.
When I'm driving out of the lot and it's like Walt Disney Studios on the thing, I'm like, fucking, I can't believe it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I pinch myself every day and I'm still like that.
And it's such a British thing to feel you have to justify your excitement there.
No, no.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, it is that thing that will be like, oh, you're Don't boast. Don't. This is no. It should be. You should be amazed. You should be coming up and going, look, I've just done this thing with Ray Liotta. How mental is that? And
then if you're not blown away by it,
yeah,
you're a dick.
Yeah, completely.
Sorry,
completely.
So is there a language thing on this?
No, there's not. No, because
I'll try and keep it down. But
it's fine. It's fine. So that kind of that was, you know, a good progression on network TV, I guess. I remember you popping up in Dexter, which again that was that was a huge show. and how was that to kind of
again jump in on? Again, I'm standing there because they shoot Dexter in LA.
Yeah,
they make it look like Miami incredibly. Yeah. But I'm there, like I had to do a scene where I'm walking to like the police precinct.
Yeah,
because the character visited the precinct, and I'm walking in there, and there's Jennifer Carpenter who plays the thing, and there's Desmond Harrington, the detectives. There's all the buns there, and fucking Dexter's down there, and I'm like in, and David Zayas who plays the Angel, you know, with the hat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're all there.
Yeah,
and I'm like, oh, I can't believe this is weird.
Yeah,
keep it together, you know, don't suck.
Yeah.
So that was amazing, and it was a lot of fun to do that part as well. It was.
It's great.
It was
that excitement should never ever go.
Yeah.
Before we were doing this, I met up with Stephen Graham for lunch, who I did a little a TV thing last year, and we're doing more next year. And he's over here, and it's announced and everything, but he's doing a film with Al Pacino, Robert De Niro.
They love him.
And Harvey Keitel.
Good
and,
for him.
Yeah, and all of these. And he was saying how nervous he was walking in. And I said to him, you realise that was me on my first day on Taboo with you and Tom Hardy. I'm walking in going, this is Stephen Graham and Tom Hardy. And they're absolute legends. I was like, and look how you treated me and how welcoming you were. That's all it is now. They're going to be as open to you and as excited about you. And he kind of was like, oh, yeah, I guess it is. I guess that is. It's just, there's always... We're bringing it back to jiu-jitsu. There's always belts above you.
Yeah, yeah.
There's levels to this game. So there's always a point where you become a white belt. And that should be exciting. That should be nice. And yeah, I love it. So which one was I going to go to? I was going to move on to Elementary, but we've talked about that.
Yeah.
But how was that to get that? Again, it's a lead in a massive... A network show, right?
Yeah, and I was like, because Eli Stone, we got the writer's strike, and then so we didn't do that season. And
right.
Then the next season, we did come back for season two, but mm-hmm. we got the axe halfway through that. So I was like,
oh, wow.
And I had a kid. We just had a kid. I just bought a house. I was
the
like,
pressure there, yeah.
Yeah, it was like. I mean, I gave myself backups, like I figured it out financially. Like I had a plan, but that was the worst scenario that could happen. It's like lose your job, your like well-paying job.
Oh, US TV is known for that kind of promising the world and then it can be pulled away from us.
Yeah. And we didn't like put ourselves in a position of that vulnerability, but we did have to like, it was tighten the purse strings time. And... I was, so when this came along, I mean, it was just like sent from heaven. And I said no initially. I said no because of, oh, there's a Sherlock thing on British TV right now. I can't be doing that. And then I came to my senses. Got my head out my arse.
Yeah.
I was like, what does it matter? I mean, you know, this could be security for my family.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. Like lots of people have done Robin Hood.
Yeah, it's fine.
It doesn't matter.
Were there any elements of looking back at where you were saying in the 90s there were roles that you were turning down, left, right and centre, and maybe it was the right choice, maybe it wasn't? Or was there an element of looking back at that and going, man, some of them turned out to be really good. What am I doing here?
No, because I think...
You know, why am I overthinking this?
Yeah, I think if you... Well, you know, not to get like deep or anything, but if you regret any of those decisions, then you obviously are not happy with where you are.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I might not have this. You know, I met someone and have a beautiful child with them.
Yeah,
and he might not be the same person.
Yeah, if I'd have
said yes to you know,
yeah,
whatever. I mean, just you can't. It's completely. Got to be how it was.
Yeah, it all opens doors for different opportunities down the line.
And different, not only in your career, but in your personal life and everything.
Yeah.
And I'm just wouldn't change a thing. I mean, I've made some poor decisions in my life.
Yeah.
Buckets of them.
Yeah.
But wouldn't change it, anything.
It's got you to where you are. You've had to make those mistakes to be where you are now.
And to have this opportunity and play this part, I think I've played Sherlock Holmes more than any other person on the planet.
That's amazing, isn't it?
By a long shot
as well. Yeah, of course, because they do. Yeah. The every other kind of iteration tends to pick one or two of the main stories, and they seem to remake them or whatever else. But yeah, in little bursts. Whereas
the way
the US TV works, that's not going to happen. You're going to be doing a lot of episodes.
We've done 126 episodes. Oh, wow. She's like, you know, and made enough. That's enough for like 30 feature films.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? So that was kind of a grace, really, or absolutely, perfectly timed moment, right?
Both, both of those things, and also it got us out of LA, and that wasn't my other half at the time. She wasn't getting on great with LA. I don't think it's a tough town for women for female actors. You know, it's anyway, brought us to New York, which is just wonderful.
Yeah,
and it's been good for my kid and me, and to have this job. You know, it's like really tough at times to do the same thing, like do the same character over and over again.
Yeah,
but you're doing it like. You're not doing the same material. It's not like being in a play for 5 years,
right,
getting up stage and doing the same play.
Yeah, yeah.
You're playing the same character, but with different material.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. So hopefully the variations there.
But yeah. And that's been really good. We get amazing actors come through. Like, sometimes you don't pay attention to the call sheet that much all the time. So you don't see the names of the other actors that are playing the parts that are coming through.
Yeah.
Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. And you'll turn up on set and it's someone you know off the telly or you've watched when you were a kid in movies.
Yeah.
Like the dude from Blade Runner this person, that person. You're like, oh my God, it's so-and-so. Yeah. I worked with a bloke from the Dukes of Hazzard last year.
Amazing.
Believe it.
And the thing with stuff like that as well is there will be characters that are hugely important to you from TV shows that you've never necessarily known who the actor is. Do you know what I mean? And things like that. So it is, they'll just appear. I did a film earlier this year called Walk Like a Panther, and genuinely, almost everyone on that call sheet has been in a show that I watched growing up or was a fan. It was one of them where I'm literally like, that's who that's just amazing to be surrounded by all these people.
Yeah, you're sitting there going, I know this bloke.
Yeah.
I fucking know this bloke, but I can't. And then penny drops, you're like...
Yeah, I love it. So,
and we shoot all over the city. And that's been another thing. It's like, it's not just... We have a stage in Long Island City where we have the inside of the brownstone Sherlock and Jones house, and the police precinct is built there as well.
Yeah.
Those are our main stages, sets that have been standing for like, you know, 6 years.
Yeah.
But everything, we do 50% of the show there and we do 50% of the show on location.
Amazing.
So we've been going to different locations for, I did four, you know, two or three, I don't know, there must be about eight locations an episode or something for the last 6 years. We shoot in the Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn, Manhattan. We go out to Long Island. We go upstate sometimes, occasionally.
Yeah.
I mean, like, to the most interesting looking places as well. Really cool.
It's,
like,
it's a good way to force you to meet the city as such. Because when you move somewhere, it's easy to find your little area,
absolutely,
know it well, and stay there. That's taking you everywhere. And going,
we're in Brownsville, we're in East New York, we're in... I mean, it's incredible.
Amazing.
We get to go everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to do... I'm generally a very unslick host, but I'm going to do a slick bit now. Speaking of playing the same character, how was it to get the call about a Trainspotting 2 and to return to... your most iconic character and, you know, the one that kind of blew it all up for you. Were there nerves over it? Was there question over whether you all should?
Huge question over it. And I think there'd been a rumour maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And then nothing happened. I think it wasn't ready. And subsequently, I found out that Danny was like, look, they made a script when Porno, the book, came out.
Yeah.
And then Danny said it just didn't do it justice, and it wasn't his favourite book anyway. Mm-hmm. So he didn't bother sending it to the actors.
Right.
And then I got a postcard. This is how cool Danny Boyle is.
Yeah.
I got a postcard, an original Trainspotting postcard of a cat drinking a bowl of milk. And it just said, Dear Johnny, having a go at T2. Script soon. Love, Danny. So,
you know. It's a hell of a postcard to get.
Yeah, and I'd worked with him on stage, actually. I had worked with him in between. We did a play at the National Theatre with Frankenstein.
Yes.
In 2011. And so...
Was that with... That wasn't with Benedict, wasn't it? Yeah, absolutely. So the two Sherlocks. Yeah, that's just... Absolutely. I hadn't put that together in my head until say that.
So that's why I had a relationship with Benedict, actually.
Yeah.
Which is sort of why I initially said no. It was one of the big reasons, because he's like one of these, someone I know and a friend. And I was like... Yeah.
How can I?
So that factored in.
Yeah.
But anyway, so to get that postcard was very exciting. But then I was always like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, of course.
And then the script eventually came, and it was really good. And I didn't like the ending.
Right.
Initially, which has changed. Which I won't go into details about that, but it's funny because the guy I hadn't been in touch with Ewan McGregor for a long time,
right?
And we sort of fell out of touch, and I got a DM from him over Twitter.
Amazing.
Yeah,
the wonders of social media.
I know, right?
Yeah,
well, it's why we're sitting here.
Yeah, exactly.
I got a DM from him. Have you read a certain script? I was like, yeah. And that, but I get worried about the Emperor's New Clothes kind of vibe, because everyone's so excited, and Bobby was really excited about it, and I was like,
yeah,
I had a big problem with it. And Danny he flew around the world visiting each and every one of us wherever we were. Like, we went to LA to visit Ewan, and Bobby lives in Vancouver because he does a show there.
Yeah,
and he came to New York to sit me, just sit down, read through the script. And you read every other part, and you read yours, and then you talk. And if you have any, you know, this is how cool he is, and how thorough he is. That's just a natural way to work for him.
Yeah,
which
that's
is
amazing why to get that immediate feedback and that immediate instinct of what works and what doesn't.
To him, there's no other way to do it.
Beautiful.
No other way to do it. It was very important to him for us all to be equal partners in it, to a certain extent. You know, for the jobs we were doing, and keep things as much as the same they were, as much as they could be. But anyway, he came to sit down with him, and that was sitting in my living room down the street, and I was like, here's my problem with it. Anyway, it turned out that one of his producers was the only other person who had the same problem with him and said that to him, and he happened to trust that bloke, so then he could listen. And I think they made a little change because of something a book that Irvin had written that just came out, which didn't sort of fit with that either, The Blade Artist.
Right.
They were going to kill Begbie.
Right. Wow.
And I was like, it got a bit much for me.
Yeah.
Like the thing about Trainspotting is the first one.
Yeah.
Is that it's so identifiable to people, I think.
Yeah.
It's everyone knows or has fucked somebody over or knows somebody who's fucked them over.
Yeah.
And that's the way it works. Like,
and knows that dark, it's, not, knows that mean, it's like, not a big bad guy type thing.
Exactly.
It's
your hero, a human element of it. The hero at the end of Trainspotting, the hero, the protagonist, fucks his mates over and leaves. And
that is bad, and it is horrible, but it's not the villain.
You understand it. It's not the villain. It's human, and you understand why he's doing it. But it's a complex question.
Yeah,
and it's identifiable. Yeah. And for me, there was a couple of elements in there which I felt were not identifiable to people.
Right.
Not everyone has experienced like a violent death.
Yeah,
or that not everyone's experienced that. Anyway, that changed. Whether it was because of that objection or whether it was because of they didn't want to kill Begbie because Irvin wrote another book about him.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
So it ended up, things ended up changing a little bit. And there were some various, he's just so responsive to that. And him and John and worked, John Hodge, the screenwriter, worked, and they came back with another version. It was much better. And, you know, it was really good anyway. Most of it's the same, but there was,
that's wicked. There was a process. That as you touched on, that equality throughout, that belief and putting value in the opinion of all the players involved,
which is different because back in the day when they made like such a great movie, we rehearsed a lot there for 3 weeks before we shot and rehearsed, and that sort of doesn't happen these days, and it couldn't happen this time. We did a bit of it, but getting us all together was like herding cats, just schedule wise. And but I'm always like, you don't really want my opinion because what it worked before without my opinion.
Yeah.
So don't ask me. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. I'll fuck it up if you ask me too much.
Amazing.
You know, that's how I feel. Right, that's how I think. But then Danny's like, no, you guys have all got, you've got like 20 more years experience in this business. Like, no, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you guys are good actors.
Amazing.
So he really wants that input.
Yeah, that's great.
And then, you know, we had costume fitting. They flew back because I'm shooting Elementary. I can't like go anywhere at the drop of it. I just can't disappear.
Yeah.
And so they came back and do costume fittings in my flat again. And he came back again. Yeah. It was just really thrilling but terrifying.
Yeah.
Because I've always come from the perspective of what's the point?
Yeah.
What is the point of doing this?
Yeah.
Like, this could be really bad.
Well, that's what I think was so great about it. And relieving as a fan as well. I went in like, is this going to tear apart these characters? But the thing I realised as I was watching it, number one, I thought you all nailed it and I thought it was the perfect follow-up. But number two, I don't remember many films that have characters that you feel you know so well that was only one film, if you know what I mean. It was weird watching T2 and going, how have we only met these guys once? But I guess it's because it was left alone for so long that it just was allowed to.
No, it's because it hit you, because it meant something to you at that time in your life.
At the right time, yeah, I guess so.
And it just, that's what happens with anything, whether it's Trainspotting or, I don't know, whether it's someone's, a band means so much to somebody because it's during a certain time. And you talk to people here, they've had, you know, people I work with had Trainspotting posters on their wall when they were at college.
And the posters were absolutely iconic,
you know,
weren't they?
And it just meant something, so you carry it with you because it was like a milestone in your life, right?
And that's it spread out to many points in the life as well, because it was the film, but then it was Born Slippy and Lust for Life, and it was the poster on your wall. It wasn't just, I watched this film once. It was like, I watched this film, but now I've listened to this soundtrack for years on. I've had the poster on my wall and seen it every day.
Every time you hear that record, it takes you back there.
You know?
But I think, still, so what's the point? And I think we all felt confident enough that the script wasn't trying to do anything like that again. It was making a comment on sort of what's the point itself. It was saying that. It was like, look, you're older. But I kept thinking, like, I'm like, look, because Danny said every time someone talks to him about it or talks to him in the run-up, they had the same questions and they want to know about what the soundtrack, you know?
Yeah.
They want to know if Kelly MacDonald's going to be in it, and they want to know what the soundtrack is.
Yeah.
And so he's thinking about the soundtrack all the time, and I'm like, yeah, but Danny, like, none of us are that cool anymore.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to be like, you know, I think you did a really good job with it, but it's like, what are you going to pick?
I mean,
you're not cool anymore.
That was what that was
your worry. You know,
that was
what I mean?
Genuinely one of the things that excited me is before it came out, I was pitched the soundtrack to sponsor the podcast. So ahead of it, I was told that it had Young Fathers on, who are one of my favourite. Like, I used to play them on my XFM show and all this, and they're Scottish and they are very cutting edge and all this. I was like, Right, so you're bringing in like
not only Scottish
Prodigy
from
remix, yeah, yeah, they're
from there, yeah.
So it's like, so you're bringing in elements of the original soundtrack. You're bringing in genuinely credible, new, exciting guys. I was like, that as much as anything got me or gave me confidence in that. As you said, it was all going to be worthwhile, and it was all going to work.
He's obsessed with the truth, Danny, and he doesn't sort of relax on. Sit back on anything. He's quick, questions everything.
Great, yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, 100%. So how, was there a level of relief when it was all finished and it was good and it worked? And because again, if you've held off for so long and then you've finally taken that step, and in many ways, you've held off for so long and then you've all moved on. Do you know what I mean? There might have been a point that you were, waiting for that a phone call from your ex of train spotting kind of thing to call you, and then you've moved on now.
Yeah, closure.
You've got your own show, you've got closure, and then they call you and go, "Should we get back together?" It's like,
yeah.
The first love has rung you up.
Train spotting keeps drunk texting me at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Exactly.
Saying,
exactly.
"You want to do a third one?"
I wanted this drunk text 10 years ago, but now I don't, you know. So how was that relief when it did all work and it did all... did you know when you were making it, or was it still that nerves until it came out and the critics and everyone kind of turned around and went, yeah, no, you've done it?
Yeah, you get... when you've got like a really colourful script with a lot of really good little vignettes in it and a lot of really good bits, when you do a bit, each little bit, you're like, oh yeah, we did something good today. You get these little kind of... so, you know, you get that vibe, actually.
Yeah.
And I think we felt that we'd done some good... then they start to add up and you start to feel, we've got a few good bits here. We've got a few good things. And then, huge relief. It's so weird. It was just one of the trippiest things ever, because just being there and doing it was so weird.
Yeah.
There was a lot of parallels. There was a lot of differences. Just being with the guys again was just wonderful.
Yeah.
And then it came out, and then it was so different because there was this massive premiere in Edinburgh. It was like, you never seen anything like it, but like a huge orange carpet going down a big. I was like, oh no, what this is? But it was like great because all of Edinburgh's come out. But you're that's the marketing side. Like, we're going to make this. We're going to sell it. We're going to sell the balls off of it. And then in a way, like, because we're all partners in it. And we're like, you know, we've all got back end deals because they couldn't pay us up front. We're like, yeah, we're going to sell it. Then we went down and we went on the craziest like press tour as well. We ended up on a Graham Norton show. Fucking what's going on?
We almost recorded this the day after or the day before the Graham Norton show, wasn't it? But it was just such a hectic
thing. It was just too much.
I prefer having these conversations when you're not on a press run. Every now and then they happen, but it's nicer to not be.
Because you'll get all the standard bullshit answers coming out that I've said three times already in the last 4 days.
Yeah, exactly.
We did Chris Evans' radio show.
Yeah.
Which is, for me, like a major blast from the past, because I remember going on TFI Friday when I was like pretty, I think, drunk. You know, and anyway, we walked into his show. We walked into the recording, into his radio show, and he's got Ewan, Bobby, me and Danny walking, stood there, and the look on his face. He was like, is this happening?
Hang on a minute.
He put his phone out. He was like, I can't believe this is happening.
That's mad, isn't it? And again, how everything has come along in that time, I guess.
It was just the biggest 90s moment ever. Chris Evans sitting there with us.
Yeah. I love it.
So it was very surreal. So there was this huge, huge relief. But then I was like straight back to the day job.
Of course, you know,
and straight back to that. And it's kind of like my memory of being in my flat in Chinatown and getting a call that we were going to do it and actually making it happen is sort of fresher than anything else.
Yeah. It's kind of weird, the parallel there, how when you made the first one, you ran off to America essentially and missed all the mayhem that was going on in the UK. Yeah. When the second one, you ran off to America, but because this time it's home and your family's there and your own TV show is there. Do you know what I mean? It's such a it's as beautiful as a story and ending and progression as anything there, that it's the same motion but for exactly. completely different reasons.
Exactly.
It's lovely. Well, I'll wrap things up there. Before we do, I need to bring the thing that truly brought us together up, which I think is Mr. Heggie. Yes. That we're both fans of Mr. Heggie. I think we've both got tattoos from Mr. Heggie. Yep.
This is, I just got this in Brooklyn actually, because he was here.
Yes, yes.
So I've got two. I've got this one.
Yep. Bit gangster, yeah.
And then I've got Don't Panic.
Yeah.
Cat on Fire.
I love him. I think he's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and I've got...
He did on my leg, he's done... It's a unicorn's head, as if it's mounted on a wall. I've tricked myself. It's a rhinoceros's head, as if it's mounted on the wall, and underneath it says unicorn.
Yeah.
Because they're just unicorns, really. And yeah.
They're just unicorns that have let themselves go.
Yeah, they're the reality of unicorns. They're real-life ones, and yeah, but... He's just the best. I love him.
Yeah, there's a bunch of guys that I work with, young guys, camera guys, sound guys, who and I took my sound, one of the sound operators.
Yeah.
They're obsessed. And he got a spaceman on his whole leg. Like that, you know, amazing. That artwork piece, yeah. That big spaceman down
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And a couple of lads are really pissed off that they couldn't get there. I mean, he's just a genius.
He truly
and,
is.
And you see that artwork and you know it's him.
Yeah.
But it's so simple.
Yeah.
And it's funny.
Yeah, I love it. It's got that.
How do you know
simplicity
him?
And scribbleness. Or he does all the artwork for my label,
right?
And it came about because when he'd first joined Instagram, he was doing a load of little portraits of rappers, and he'd done Biggie and all these legends, and then he did me, and I was like,
did that Bye Felicia one of like Bye Felicia, yeah, of, Ice Cube,
right? Yeah, yeah, and I was like. This is great. Like, would you like to design a T-shirt or something? And since then, he's designed all my T-shirts, all my merch, all the like our label of the record label,
the
logo and that. And yeah,
did you?
I love him. He's wonderful.
Did you find him on Instagram then?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
did I.
Yeah, and that's how we kind of connected on
Instagram. I love
Instagram. And
because for that, I've got, including Heggie, I've got maybe four or five artists.
Yeah.
Work in my flat
yeah
that I found on Instagram
yeah I've got
there you go
the upstairs of my house I've got four prints of Heggie's that were small ones and I paid him to do big full size ones so I could properly frame them so
yes
and my little hallway upstairs is like a little Heggie art gallery that's just
brilliant
four of his prints that just look amazing and
brilliant I found a guy that takes toy photographs
right
that looks so good, and he takes of Star Wars figures predominantly.
Oh, amazing!
And he's a U.S. Army combat vet.
Yeah,
his name's Captain Chaos with a K. Captain
right.
Chaos.
Yeah,
and he takes these photographs, but he's got like two stormtroopers in a trench, but he'll blow stuff up around them, either using an air gun or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's bits of dirt flying through the air and these things, and then he'll write a thing under, we've been pinned down for 4 days.
Amazing.
So I've got these metallic prints of a couple of stormtrooper battle scenes and Boba Fett.
Yeah.
And they look brilliant.
I love that.
Anyway.
There's an Instagram account that isn't used anymore. It's gone dead, but all the pictures are still there that I was obsessed with, and it's just called From Vader With Love. And this woman has put a Vader helmet on just a naked body, like a naked man doll body, and has just done all these sexy poses, blurring out genitalia each time. And it's just a series of erotic shots of Vader as a doll.
But it's a doll.
Yeah, but it's but it's a doll. And again, they're genuinely beautifully shot and beautifully done.
Yeah,
and all
this.
I was gutted when I stopped doing it. But yeah, that's one to go and look at and scroll through because there's endless hilarious pictures there. Well, there you go. Thank you very much for chatting. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Piece.
There you go. That was Johnny Lee Miller. On episode 178, what an absolute dude. I loved it. I loved discussing Sick Boy as a character. And then the kind of weirdness that happened after with all the hype that was behind him and how he missed some of that. And then how he turned it all back round and is doing amazing in elementary and stuff like that. So that was cool. If you
enjoyed that one. I've had a load of other good people on in the past. People like James McAvoy, Stephen Graham, like on the actors front, Kathy Burke, Alice Lowe. Some really good people. So scroll through the back catalogue and have a little look. Stick around till the very end and you'll get Pip's Pod Picks. The way the advertising works is it's not on every episode, but it's on a lot of them. So if you miss it, then you'll get one in the end. Don't worry, there's some good recommendations. Yeah, I'll see you next week for Rick Edwards, which is a great episode. I'm back to asking you to like and subscribe and rate and review. I mean, I stopped for a while, but then iTunes has done that rejig on the latest update and it's kind of easier to give a 5-star rating. I'd like 5-star ratings and reviews, and it helps spread the word to other people and get the word out there. My percentage ratio at the moment is insane. Like I've got overall a 5-star average. So if you could keep that, that'd be awesome. But if you could push that beyond any possible other level, then that'd be even better. But you don't have to. It's fine. At social media, I'm having a long ending now. I'm feeling all rambly. At social media, I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook at ScroobiusPipYo or facebook.com/ScroobiusPip. So check me out. And check out the Distraction Pieces Network pages. There's a Distraction Pieces Network page on Twitter, on Instagram and on Facebook. And they're really good for posting stuff that I don't post on my page. Just cool stuff about the network. A little snippets of some of the podcasts and just good little videos and stuff like that. So keep an eye on them. That's all for you for now. Oh, I didn't mention on the drunk cast that we're going to have John Harris, who runs a lot of the social media for the Distraction Pieces Network. He'll be joining us. He's got a load of good podcasts too. And he'll be joining us as a kind of background guide to look things up and Google stuff and throw facts and information in our direction. So it's going to be a fun episode. So the drunk cast ones will be here at the end of the year, as it should be. And I'll see you all next week. Ta-ta!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.